Good morning and welcome to the Government Operations Committee meeting for Tuesday, March 27, 2018. The first item of business that we're taking up is the approval of the minutes from the meeting of March 21st. Representative Nelson, have you had a chance to review the minutes, sir?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I would move approval of the minutes from the March 21st meeting.
Representative Nelson moves approval of the minutes from March 21st. Any discussion, corrections, deletions? Seeing none, hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, the motion prevails. Representative Grassl, you have the first bill up this morning, sir. Thank you. I will move House File 3611, before the committee to be re-referred to the General Register. Representative Grassl, welcome to the committee, and if you'll proceed with your bill setup for us this morning, sir. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee. 3611 is a bill that is a prohibition on disarming local law enforcement officers, unless expressly authorized under another section of law. A mayor, city council, county board, or chief law enforcement officer may not disarm a peace officer who is in good standing or currently under investigation or subject to disciplinary action. The bill I have introduced will prohibit the mentioned entities from disarming their police forces. This came about from some past recent history of politicians making that type of suggestion, and from my own experiences 17 years ago, when I started as a police officer, a man tried to shoot me in the face and then shot me through the arm as I was fighting with him to disarm him. My partner at that time was able to come to my aid and stop the threat. So to have somebody mention that one of their thoughts is to disarm the police, it kind of is a little bit alarming, because the officers need to have every tool of their trade. They need to have every tool in order not only to protect themselves, but to protect the community. And so I'm putting this bill forward to make sure that they have all the tools of their trade so that they can perform their duties safely and make sure that we take care of the public.
Representative Grassl, thank you for the setup on the bill. I don't have any member questions right now. I don't have anybody that has signed up to testify, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to move to the public testimony phase. Is there anyone here today present that would like to speak on House File 3611 that is before the committee this morning? Anyone wishing to speak on House File 3611 that's before the committee? Seeing none, any member questions? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Grassl. So I get this right. I remember the mayor candidate for the city of Minneapolis that made that statement, and it concerns me. I mean, I don't see anything really wrong with the bill, and I understand where you're coming from, but sometimes when we pass legislation that's reacting to somebody's statement or news story, I don't know if it's necessary to pass legislation like that or pass it on. It's we're reacting, and sometimes later on down the road, bad things can happen. I don't possibly see that with this, but it concerns me that the precedent of just passing a legislation because I saw something somebody said on the news, I saw something somebody said in a campaign, and now I'm going to react to pass legislation to do it. It's kind of the wrong type of bills we should be passing. But as far as this goes, I'm not going to object to it, but I just wanted to put that on the record that sometimes we react and we pass legislation that's not necessary, and later on down the road, unnecessary things, consequences happen that we didn't even think about because we're in a hurry to pass something as a reaction to something else.
Other member questions at this time? Seeing none, Representative Grassl, thank you for your service to the people in law enforcement. And I have a similar story, not for myself, but for my father, who was in law enforcement and almost died in my presence as a result of performing his duties. And I can assure you that the officers that came to his aid, the tools that you were referring to, are very helpful in subduing that situation. So, Representative Grassl, I certainly will be supporting your bill today as well. Any other member questions? Seeing none and hearing none, I renew my motion that House File 3611 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion prevails. Representative Grassley, you are on your way, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Committee.
The next bill on the agenda is House File 4169. Representative Schumacher, Chair Schumacher, if you'll make your way to the testifying table. And as you do that, I will move House File 4169 to be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Representative Schumacher, if you will proceed with your bill setup.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 4169 is the clone bill to House File 3848, which is the Nurse Licensure Compact bill. This legislation establishes Minnesota's participation in the Enhanced Nurse Licensure Compact. The compact provides Minnesota nurses the opportunity to obtain one multi-state license to practice in multiple states while preserving public protections at the state level. It was developed in the late 1990s by the National Council of State Boards of Nursing to remove major barriers to nursing practicing across state lines and to increase access to nurse care for patients. Since then, the compact has been adopted by 25 states, with more joining each year. Minnesota is not currently a member of the compact, but all four of our border states are. This geographic isolation creates additional burdens to Minnesota nurses compared to those in neighboring states who do not face those same burdens. Not surprisingly, nurses strongly support Minnesota joining the compact. A March 2017 survey of the Minnesota Board of Nursing reveals that over 80% of nurses favor Minnesota's participation in the compact, with fewer than 5% opposing. Nurses who hold compact licenses in other states, currently 93% of those said that a compact would be beneficial, has been beneficial for them. In addition to these benefits for nurses, joining the compact is becoming more important every day as nurses' practice evolves. Minnesota nurses care for patients in all 50 states. The expansion of telehealth services and case management makes the ability for nurses to deliver care across state lines essential. With that, members, I have with me today Shirley Brecken, Executive Director for the Board of Nursing, who will walk through the bill.
Thank you, Representative Schumacher, for the setup. Good morning and welcome to the committee. If you will state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Shirley Brecken, and I am the Executive Director for the Board of Nursing. I know that you know an interstate compact is an agreement between one or more states that addresses an issue of public concern. In this case, the current Enhanced Nurse Licensure Compact is an agreement among 29 states, including those that border on Minnesota, to recognize a nurse license issued by one of those states, that is the state of residence of the nurse, as authority to practice in the other party states, either by telehealth or in person. Now, interstate compacts are not new to Minnesota. Minnesota is a member of many compacts, including placement of children, adult offenders, a transfer, the driver's license compact, and last year the legislature enacted the Minnesota Physician Interstate Licensure Compact. Later on, I'll share how many of the provisions which were enacted last year are the same as in this compact bill. This is the Enhanced Nurse Licensure Compact. The original Nurse Licensure Compact was in effect for almost 20 years between 25 states. However, effective January 19th of this year, a new and improved compact called the ENLC went into effect. Since that time, 29 states have adopted the new or ENLC, and there are bills active in 8 other states. This bill enacts the ENLC, which provides that a nurse hold one nurse license in the state of primary residence. That multi-state license authorizes the nurse to practice in all other states that are in the compact under a multi-state privilege. If you think of it as liken it to the driver's license, you have a license in your home state or state of residence, which gives you authority to drive in other party states without getting a license in those states. But regardless of which state issued you the license, you must abide by the laws of the state in which you are driving. Sometimes the speed limit is different, or the age of attaining a license is different. Now, pursuant to the Nurse Licensure Compact, the home state issues the nurse license, and a nurse may practice in any other compact state on that license. the nurse must practice according to the laws of the state where the practice occurs, that is, where the patient is located, either in person or electronically by telehealth. And the licensure information, including any action against the license, must be submitted to the National Nurse Database, known as NURSIS. It's important to recognize that only the home state can take action against the license. However, a party state, any other state in the compact, can take action against the multi-state privilege. If there is a violation in the state where the patient is located, the patient can file a complaint with that Board of Nursing where the patient is located and where the practice occurred. This state then can take action against that multi-state privilege. Generally, the party state where the violation occurred, in consultation with the home state, carries out the investigation. If the allegations are found to be true, the state will take action against the multi-state privilege, and the home state will take action against the license, and the individual no longer has a multi-state privilege in any state. One concern that has been raised is that a nurse may be subject to several states in disciplinary proceedings. However, once the home state has taken action against the license reverts to a single state license, and the nurse no longer has a multi-state license. Now, I've described basically what the compact does, and I'll just give you an overview of each of the provisions in the compact. Article 1 provides for definitions, and the most important definitions to think about are the home state, that is the state of residence for the nurse's license, and party states, that's all of the other states that are in the compact. Article 2 provides the uniform licensure requirements an individual must meet to be eligible for a multi-state license, and this is the major change between the previous compact and the new and improved compact. This provides for uniform licensure requirements. Lines 3.17 through 4.5 are common to Minnesota right now. You have to have graduated from an approved school of nursing. You must have passed the National Nurse Licensure Examination, or NCLEX as it's called, and you must submit to a fingerprint-based criminal background check. Lines 4.6 through 4.14 list requirements that are more strict than those required to get a license in Minnesota right now. You can never have been convicted of a felony. You can never have been convicted of a misdemeanor offense related to the practice of nursing. An example of that would be theft from a patient. You cannot be enrolled in an alternative program that is like Minnesota's Health Professional Services Program, which monitors individuals whose practice may be impaired due to illness such as chemical dependency. And you must have a Social Security number. Someone who does not meet these requirements will not get a multi-state license. However, they may be eligible for a single state license. The intent is to protect the public by not allowing a nurse to practice in other compact states without that greater license. This article also provides that the nurse must practice in compliance with the state law where the patient is, and that the state can take action against that multi-state privilege. Article 3 requires that the state submit data to and use data from a national coordinated licensure system. And Minnesota currently participates in that system where we provide all of the licensure information and disciplinary action so that other state boards of nursing can have access to that information. Article 4 provides authority to take adverse action against the multi-state licensure privilege, and it allows the board to revoke that privilege and gives the board authority to issue subpoenas across state lines. Last year, this legislature passed the Physician Licensure Compact. Articles 5 through 10 in the bill are similar or the same as, in many instances, word for word, as in the physician compact. Article 5 addresses the coordinated licensure information system and how the states exchange information. Article 6 establishes the governing body to be an interstate commission, just like the physician's interstate commission that is now in effect. Article 7 allows for rules to be adopted by the commission. Such rulemaking authority has been permitted and exercised in other interstate compacts, and again, is very much like the physician compact adopted last year. Article 8 ensures compliance by ENLC by member states, so that it provides for procedures to be followed in the event of a failure by a party state to comply with the ENLC. It provides for technical assistance, dispute resolution, and termination from the compact if improvement is not made. And Article 9 addresses the method to enter, withdraw from, or amend the ENLC. And Article 10 provides for the compact to remain valid in a state when any provision is declared to be contrary to a party state's constitution. Section 2 of the bill includes laws in Minnesota for which they're, how they're applied to the compact. So Section 1, the first section, is the compact and cannot be altered. It must be adopted by every state the same. Section 2 is the part that applies certain Minnesota laws or calls them out. And in particular, I'd call your attention to that it provides that this compact does not supersede Minnesota's labor laws. And with that said, I would be happy to answer any questions that committee members may have.
I do have one member question at this time. And Representative Schumacher, I don't know if you have other testifiers that you have on your behalf this morning on the bill, but if you do, we'll ask you to go ahead and queue them up. I know we have some who have signed up to testify on the bill, but Representative Freiberg has a question at this time. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the question is for the bill author. This bill is following kind of a strange process. This is, I think, the first time I've ever been in two committees hearing the same bill 2 hours apart. I recognize this is a clone bill, and I see what's going on there. But we heard this 2 hours ago, maybe not even that, in the Health and Human Services Reform Committee. There was an author's amendment adopted in that committee that there was a little bit of confusion about, but it was ultimately adopted. So I guess I'm just unclear. You know, it seems like it's no longer a clone. It's got some differences there, and I don't see any amendment in our packet here. So I'm just curious what's going on or what the plan is for that.
Sure. Well, before I go to the bill author, it sounds like it's Groundhog Day for you today, Representative Freiberg. Chair Schumacher to Representative Freiberg's question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Freiberg. Yes, there was an amendment that was adopted in the Health and Human Service Reform Committee this morning that took it from the basic Nurse Licensure Compact Bill to the Enhanced Nurse Licensure Compact Bill. I spoke with the committee chair and the DFL lead on this, and understanding what we have here and that it is a clone bill, had agreed that we could walk through what the amendment was in order to make changes, in order to discuss those changes, but didn't have to adopt anything today for that.
Representative Nelson, since your name was referenced.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's my understanding, though, the amendment that Representative Freiberg talked about did not make a 24-hour deadline here. And as far as the clone bill, sometimes during the last couple of weeks when you're hitting a deadline, you'll have clone bills, and we've done that, and when we've been a majority too, you'll have clone bills that are going to multiple committees so that the gist of what those committees need to hear gets heard, and then they come back together in the end. And so whether the bill passes here or not or whatever, we will have heard the those parts of it, and whether the amendment goes on or not, we will hear the parts of it and vote on it. And we have heard the part, and that's what's required by our House rules. So it's something both parties have done when they've been in the majority, send clone bills so that all parts can get heard.
Representative
upper committees.
Oh, Representative Freiberg, follow up.
Thank you. I understand that's what's going on here. I just wasn't sure, since one was amended, how it would work exactly.
Representative Schumacher, since the question is on the table, maybe you want to do a brief overview of some of those changes that were done in HHS and that will be done at a later point in time on this clone bill.
Yes, I would have Ms. Brecken walk through the detailed points.
Second, if you would.
Okay, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, if you would look on page 18, section 2 of the bill, I'll try to do a very high level or a quick walkthrough of that. The first amendment deletes lines 18.30 to 18.33 on page 18, and following up on page 19, lines 19.1 to 19.3. And the reason that that is proposed for deletion is that it's covered in the compact, so it's additional sort of redundant language that's not needed. The next changes are lettering. Changing on line 19.4, changing the B to an A. On line 19.6, changing the C to a B. And on 19.7, changing a D to a C. The next section for deletion is our lines 19.11 through 19.13. And again, it refers to rulemaking, and the rulemaking is covered within the compact, giving that authority to the commission. The next change is on line 19.14, changing an F to a D, and that is the next section is a deletion, lines 19.17 to 19.24, and again, that is covered in the compact because the compact specifically states that the nurse practicing in Minnesota or practicing in a state where the patient is located must abide by all the laws and rules that apply to nursing practice in the state. On line 19.25, an H is changed to an E. On line 19.29, I is changed to an F. On line 20.1, the J is changed to G. 20.4, K to H. And line 20.7, L to an I. Line 20.9 changes M to J. And line 20.11 changes N to K. The next provisions, there's a deletion proposed for lines in the amendment for lines 20.14 through lines 20.26. And again, because those are provisions that are provided for in the ENLC or in the compact language. And that's it.
Representative Jessup, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. And two questions for the testifier. One is, could you just confirm, I think I heard you said that there's a number of other states that have gone ahead and established this compact, and I believe you mentioned that South Dakota, North Dakota, Iowa, Wisconsin are all okay. That's my first question. Second question is, you mentioned that this compact actually has a few stricter requirements than the license that is already established for Minnesota. And I was curious about background checks. Do we today do a background check for Minnesota license, and do we require, you know, going through the FBI database?
Before I answer that question, I want to remind members that because of the nature of this bill and because our committee ends up seeing quite a number of bills, I did allow some latitude for the chief author and their testifiers to background on this. We are here today for the purpose of rulemaking on this. The question that was asked by Representative Jessup is something that is more of a civil law, but I will ask the testifier to briefly background with that. And we also have Representative Pugh with a question and a number of testifiers that would like to be with us. And given the robust nature of our bill today, I'm going to ask that we stay to the rulemaking related provisions, if we would. To the testifier and Representative Jessup's question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. Yes, the bill actually provides, the compact actually provides for a higher level or a higher bar for licensure. Obviously, if you're authorizing individuals to cross state lines, you want to be able to assure that they have the highest considerations for licensure. So things such as you cannot ever have been convicted of a felony or convicted of a misdemeanor related to the practice of nursing. Those are currently not requirements for licensure in Minnesota, but they would be for any nurse, even a Minnesota nurse, to get a multi-state license.
Representative Pugh.
So
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will keep my comments very brief because they're not specific to rulemaking, but thank you, Chair Schumacher, for having brought this bill. And to the testifier, I had a number of questions about this prior to your testimony, but it was so comprehensive. All of my questions were answered, so I greatly appreciate that. I just wanted to draw attention to a number of the letters of support that we've received in our packet, and specifically one from Gillette, where our kids experienced treatment, when they were much younger, and it highlights that this enhanced nurse licensure compact is going to be that much more critical going forward given the prevalence of telemedicine. And I just wanted to highlight that. I think this is just very important in order to provide care for many beyond the location. So anyway, thank you very much. This is I'm pleased to that we're hearing this bill.
And Representative Schumacher, with that, did you have any other testifiers?
Briefly, I do, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And then I will ask those who have also asked to testify, Shannon Cunningham, if you would like to get in line, Laura Salas, and Catherine Combe, I believe I'm pronouncing those names correct. If you want to check in with Santa, she'll get you signed in, and we'll get you moving as quickly as we can here this morning as well. Good morning and welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name and who you represent, proceed with your testimony. Before you do that, members, I want to stand corrected. We have rulemaking, and because there's an interstate compact, that is also within the jurisdiction of our committee. I wanted to provide clarification on that. Please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and member of committees. My name is Diane Twiddell. I'm a registered nurse and immediate past president of the Minnesota Organization of Leaders in Nursing, MOLN. And I'm speaking on behalf of MOLN in support of House File 4169, Nurse Licensure Compact. The MOLN is a nonprofit organization that consists of nurse leaders throughout the state and gives nurse leaders a collective voice in guiding nurses and impacting the healthcare system in Minnesota. I'm here today to share that MOLN supports Minnesota in joining the Nurse Licensure Compact. The NLC increases access to healthcare, protects patient safety, reduces costs, and supports state-of-the-art healthcare delivery. It also enhances nurses' mobility across states and allows nurses to quickly cross state borders when there is a disaster. The NLC is also cost-effective, both for organizations and individual nurses. Organizations and or individual nurses pay for licensure fees for multiple state licenses because they provide telehealth care across state lines or direct patient care across state lines, such as a flight nurse. MOLN sees adoption of the NLC in Minnesota as providing Minnesota nurses with an opportunity to provide their expertise and skilled services to patients in border states and in currently 29 states throughout the country more efficiently. We're all working to provide our patients with the best health care. Our care models have evolved. Instead of patients coming to us to receive care, we are delivering care where the patient is. And many times this is virtually through a telephonic visit, a virtual visit through iPad technology, or even an e-visit through an electronic email exchange. We recognize we will not be treating patients the same in the future as we are today, and we need to be prepared to meet the needs of our patients and evolve to accommodate new models of care. The NLC helps break down state boundaries that are not relevant to providing patients with safe quality care. Representative Schumacher referenced a Minnesota Board of Nursing survey from 2017. Almost 40% of all respondents in that survey reported that they had provided nursing services to and or communicated with patients or clients located in a state other than Minnesota. Critics of the Nurse Licensure Compact will cite that because the compact does not require continuing education hours, that less competent or less educated nurses will provide care in the state of Minnesota. A study by the National Council of State Boards of Nursing concludes that there is no evidence that completion of continuing education requirements equates to competence. Research shows that nurses tend to accumulate continuing education hours whether or not they are mandated to do so. In states where continuing education is not mandated, licensees complete an average of 32 hours of continuing education and more often complete continuing ed that relates to their practice setting or specialization. It's time for the NLC in Minnesota. Minnesota is seen as a national leader in safe, quality health care. Our patients don't stay within the circumscribed boundaries of Minnesota at all times. Why should we expect our nurses to have to conform to the same boundaries with their practice? It's time for us to support a nurse licensure system that supports our health care system. Thank you for your time and consideration of this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. The next testifier I have on the list is Shannon Cunningham. She'll make her way to the testifying table. Good morning, Ms. Cunningham, and welcome to the committee. I'll ask you to state your name and who you represent, and then proceed with your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Apologies for those of you who've heard me already this morning, but my name is Shannon Cunningham, and I'm the Director for Governmental Relations for the Minnesota Nurses Association. So first off, I just wanted to say that MNA is somewhat alarmed by the fast pace that this bill is taking throughout the legislative session. It was actually just introduced a few weeks ago, so fairly late in the legislative session. With two hearings today, there was one in the Senate last week, we just want to ask that maybe that we take a step back and really consider some of the issues that are with the compact. And, I've been doing this for quite a while, as many of you have, and I'm always suspicious when a bill is moved through a process so quickly. And so while I certainly understand that everybody is here to try to make some changes that we believe are positive, really just want to ask that we continue to do our due diligence on the bill. I also wanted to address a couple comments made about the survey that the Board of Nursing provided. Just wanted to clarify that while the survey was sent out to roughly 120,000 registered nurses, 20% of those who, only 20% responded to that survey, and of that, 20% were actually not even Minnesota residents, and only about 40% were nurses working in hospitals, which is where the majority of MNA represents our membership. And we're just sort of alarmed by some of the leading comments that were addressed in that survey, including making leading statements such as describing the compact as a solution and also telling respondents before they had to answer the questions that it would ultimately serve to improve patient care and safety. As requested, trying to keep my comments to the jurisdiction of the committee, but also wanted to express some concern about the loss of control that Minnesota would have over some rulemaking and legislation under the compact. Currently, the Minnesota statute requires that our Board of Nursing maintain a record of all people licensed by the Board to practice nursing in the state of Minnesota. Unfortunately, if we join the compact, nurses from other compact states will never have to report to our Board of Nursing, so we will be unaware that they are practicing here. Even now, with border reciprocity and nurses who are in those border states working within Minnesota, they are required to report to the Board of Nursing within 10 days. Given that the Board's mission is to protect the public's health and safety through the regulation of nursing, licensure, and practice, it just seems that that loss of information could really hinder that mission. We also have some concerns that the compact would prohibit our state government to put limits or any sort of anything around continuing education. The Board of Nursing will be unable to require nurses who are coming from compact states to abide by those same continuing education standards that Minnesota nurses are required to abide by. So, for example, recently there was a bill passing through the legislature which would require anyone with prescribing authority to take 2 hours of continuing education on opioids, which is, very, very severe issue we're trying to address right now. If Minnesota were to join the compact, we would be unable to make registered nurses have that same requirement if the legislature so desired. And so it really hinders our ability to put certain caveats on the nursing profession. And then lastly, just some pretty big concerns about the revenue loss for the state of Minnesota. Previous years, the Board of Nursing has said that this would have a decrease in renewals, which would mean a decrease in subsequent renewal fees due to the implementation of the compact. The loss of revenue is going to result likely in an increase of licensure fees for actually Minnesota's own registered nurses who are licensed here as their home state, and we found this to be true in other states. So, for example, the state of Virginia found that there would be an annual loss of $200,000 if they were to join the Nurse Licensure Compact. That is obviously a large part of the Board of Nursing's budget, and we have some concerns that, of course, we would need to make up that money somewhere else, and we very much worry that that's going to happen on the backs of Minnesota registered nurses. So for these reasons and many more, which some people have heard in the policy committee, we really ask that you slow down the process on this bill and vote no on it. We are happy to continue having conversations about how we can increase access to telehealth, but we don't believe that the compact is the way to do so.
Representative Nelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Cunningham. The earlier testifier said something that this just replaces or updating a compact that's already out there with 25 states. Are we part of that compact that's currently out there, or is this something new?
Ms. Cunningham.
We are not part of the original compact. The legislation has been before the legislature, for many years, the six that I've been working on this bill, but we have declined to join the original compact as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome, Representative Nelson. Seeing no other questions, thank you, Ms. Cunningham. Ms. Salas, followed by Ms. Combe. And then again, if there's anyone else who would like to testify who has not had a chance to testify, I ask you to make your way forward, and Sam will queue you up and bring you into the testifying rotation. Good morning, Ms. Salas, and welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name and who you represent,
sure,
proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Laura Sales.
Sorry.
And I'm a lobbyist for the Minnesota Nurses Association. And I just want to close out our testimony with a few remarks about the Nurse Licensure Compact and issues of state sovereignty and legislative authority. The compact creates a new bureaucracy with significant power over Minnesota. The NLC creates an interstate commission with implementation and enforcement powers, including adopting rules and assessing payments from participating states. This commission has the power to enact administrative rules that are binding on Minnesota. Therefore, Minnesota would be subject to administrative rules that they have not passed at the state level. The Interstate Commission also has the power to adopt budgets and collect annual assessments from Minnesota to cover their cost of operations. The Commission can terminate Minnesota for defaulting in the performance of its obligations or responsibilities under the compact or Commission rules. Compounding this problem, there is no oversight or accountability for the Commission's decisions. While Minnesota's representative is accountable to Minnesota, the Commission itself doesn't seem to be accountable to, the Commission itself is accountable to no one. Adopting the Nurse Licensure Compact would also have an impact on Minnesota's legislative authority to determine some of the qualifications needed to practice in Minnesota. Currently, the Minnesota Board of Nursing licenses and oversees nurses who work in the state. The compact's absolute reciprocity language allows other states to determine the qualifications for relicensure for those who are practicing in Minnesota under a multi-state license. So the compact could be seen as taking away some of Minnesota's legislative authority. And for these reasons and the reasons given by my colleague, we respectfully oppose this piece of legislation. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony this morning. Representative Nelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. First off, I want to ask for a roll call on the bill. And second, I just want to say I heard this right, and I think the people in the committee should listen to this. We have a lot of issues with people not wanting our state divisions making rules, and we've had a lot of conversation here in different committees about the rulemaking process in the state of Minnesota, which we ultimately have the right to overturn through legislation. But this is giving rulemaking authority to a group outside of Minnesota who will then put those rules onto Minnesota, and we won't have the ability as a state to overturn those rules that are put in place. I find that concerning. So
thank you, Representative Nelson. Ms. Combe?
Welcome
to the committee. They'll state your name and who you represent and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Catherine Kane, your school afternoons.
I'm 0 for 2, sorry.
I'm a registered nurse and the executive director of the Minnesota Organization of Registered Nurses. We are Minnesota's member of the American Nurses Association. Our members are RNs and APRNs located throughout the state doing everything imaginable that you could do in nursing. We refer to our members representing the community of nurses because of the variety of roles and settings and where they work. In regards to HF 4169, which would have nurses in Minnesota join the already created Nurse Licensure Compact, the Minnesota Organization of Registered Nurses believes that issues surrounding the compact are too complex to be adequately considered during this short legislative session. I brought my cell phone up with me because I think telehealth is really one of the biggest things that the compact would be used for, although we know that nurses want to flock to Minnesota to work because we have such a wonderful climate. I've been on a few road trips recently and always with my same area code. So if I was going to be called by my nurse while I was on my road trip, I would always be in the same area code and I'd always be in a different state. If I was going to California, just think of all the nurse practice acts the nurse would have to know if she was calling me with ongoing concerns while I was on my road trip. So my frame of reference is really for the nurse in Minnesota who's practicing on the compact language. While the MNRN supports strategies that allow nurses to practice across boundaries, we believe those strategies should maintain Minnesota's ability to have jurisdiction over the Nurse Practice Act, including the disciplinary complaint process. In 2013, following a series of articles about nurses in trouble getting second chances and a subsequent report from the Office of the Legislative Auditor on the complaint resolution process, the Minnesota legislature clearly identified the importance of the legislature in ensuring that the Board of Nursing has the appropriate authority to discipline nurses while ensuring also that individual nurses' rights are maintained. MNRN strongly supports the legislature maintain its authority in these disciplinary and complaint resolution matters. On the NCSBN website, a video was posted in June of 2017, which addressed the disciplinary process under the Enhanced Nurse Licensure Compact. The executive director from the Idaho Nurses Board of Nursing, the Idaho Board of Nursing, made some comments, general comments, before she started talking about the disciplinary and complaint process. Some of these comments are of concern to MNRN. She said, quote, "What's considered to be a violation in one state may not be a violation in another state." Quote, "Once adopted, the compact actually takes precedence over your own state law." She cited the fact that Idaho had introduced three bills that hadn't passed prior to the adoption of the compact, but after the compact was adopted, they didn't have to go back to the legislature, that, quote, "the changes were accomplished through the compact itself," unquote. She also stated that an act may be a violation of one state law, but not a violation of another state law. Forms and levels of discipline differ from state to state, and actions you can take against a nurse are limited by the own state law. So again, going back to my road trip analogy, things could change for the nurse depending on what state I was in as the patient. Under the proposed Nurse Licensure Compact, if adopted, nurses in Minnesota could be disciplined in states referred to as remote states as well as in Minnesota. It could be possible for a nurse to go through a disciplinary complaint process in multiple states, all with different processes and different grounds for discipline. Just the cost of hiring attorneys in multiple states would likely be prohibitive on a nurse's salary. While the Nurse Licensure Compact provides a solution for practicing nursing across borders, components of the Nurse Licensure Compact deserve a full and informed hearing at the Capitol. Besides discipline and complaint resolution, there are issues around the coordinated licensure information system and exchange of information, the establishment of the Interstate Commission of Nurse Licensure Compact Administrators and their authority in rulemaking, and construction and severability that need to be clearly understood so that the legislature can be assured that they are maintaining their authority over the Minnesota Board of Nursing and the practice of nursing in our state. MNRN asks that HF4169, the Nurse Licensure Compact, not be considered during this legislative session. Thank you for letting me address the committee.
Thank you. Is there anyone else wishing to testify on the matter before the committee this morning? Anyone else wishing to testify on the matter before the committee this morning? Representative Quam, followed by Representative Freiberg. Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the members, a few of us on this committee have already heard this in past years, and I believe we actually passed out of the House the older version of this, so this isn't just a few weeks ago discussion before the chamber. Basically, we've got about three dozen compacts the state has joined in, and a couple of them, mental health and medical licensure compact, the state's already involved with. So this is not cutting extremely new ground. And I just wanted people to, we're discussing the compact portion of it. So, again, I think it's quite reasonable and consistent with past practices.
I'm going to give that. I didn't hear a question. I think it was a comment, a statement. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad to follow that, actually, and because I don't have a problem with compacts per se. I'm actually chief author of a bill to have us sign into another one related to a national popular vote. Thinking of that, I wish I'd thought to offer this as an amendment to this bill. It might have been germane since they both deal with compacts. I do think, though, it matters what the compact is trying to accomplish, how it's structured. I don't think we should approve something just because we have compacts in other areas. I think we need to look closely at it. And to that end, I do have a few questions, either for the bill author or maybe the testifier who's up at the table. And these are all just based on specific language in the bill, all out of Article 6 of the bill, which starts on page 8, that deals with the establishment of the compact. So it's within this committee's jurisdiction, and I did not ask these questions in health reform, which I also sit on. So on line 8.30, it says that venue is proper and judicial proceedings by or against the commission shall be brought solely and exclusively in a court of competent jurisdiction where the principal office of the commission is located. I guess my question at first is, which state is the commission located in?
Before you answer that question, Representative Schumacher, I'm going to let you know that we have about 58 minutes left, and we do have a couple of other bills. And so given the robust nature of the discussion today, we're contemplating here shortly about what time we'll be coming back this evening for committee as well. Representative Schumacher.
Mr. Chair, Representative Freiberg, I'll have Ms. Brecken address that.
Yes. Mr. Chair,
please proceed.
And Representative Freiberg, Article 6, as you point out, does establish the commission, and it's actually the same language that establishes the commission in the physician compact that was passed in the legislature last year. In this instance, in referring to the venue of the court, the commission currently is located in sort of virtually, I would say, but the staff or the commission are located in Chicago.
Representative Freiberg, follow-up.
Thank you. So if a Minnesotan had an issue with the commission that required a judicial solution, they would have to file suit in an Illinois court, according to this language. Is that correct?
Proceed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Freiberg, not being an attorney, I would say that would be my read also.
Representative Fabio, you may want to refer to lines 9.1 and 9.2. That might be helpful with your questions. Was there any other questions you had this morning, Representative Freiberg, as well?
Yes, thank you.
Go ahead.
On line 12.21, Ms. Sales spoke about this too. It says that the commission may also levy on and collect an annual assessment from each party state to cover the cost of its operations, activities, and staff, and its annual budget is approved each year. Just wondering where the funds for that levy might come from. Does it come from the general fund? Does it come from licensing fees? Just wondering what the answer to that was.
Mr. Chair, Representative Freiberg, yes, again, that is the same language that is in the physician compact. The amount of the annual assessment to date is $6,000 a year, and it is paid by the Board of Nursing, and that is from licensure fees. But the Board of Nursing is completely fee-funded. There are no general fund dollars.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you. Just one more question. I think it's a quick one. Line 13.4, it says that the administrators, officers, executive director, employees, and representatives of the commission shall be immune from suit and liability, either personally or in their official capacity. I don't know. I guess my earlier question, was about a Minnesotan having to file suit in a court in Illinois. Would they even be able to do that if they had an issue with the commission?
Again, I realize that you had a couple of questions. 9.1, 9.2 may help with that on a venue waiver. Seeing no other questions, Representative Schumacher, I just have two other things very quickly for you. Has the state of Minnesota ever passed any other medical-related compacts in the past?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I couldn't list them for you, but there are some.
One that I'm familiar with that I think that many of the people that sit on this committee that passed 125 to nothing about a little less than 3 years ago off the House floor, 125 to nothing again, would have been a physician licensing compact as well. And many of the questions that were raised here today, I think, would have also been questions that might have been of concern to people that were able to be resolved through the compact as well. I just want to point that out. And just from a historical perspective, that a roll call being requested, we'll get a chance to see if people line up today with how they handle the physician licensing vote or the vote paying committee. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you. I guess maybe this question's for you, Mr. Chair, since you referenced line 9.1 and 9.2. The language there says the commission may waive venue and jurisdictional defenses to the extent it adopts or consents to participate in alternative dispute resolution proceedings. Does that require the commission to waive venue?
Mr. Guerin, can you provide assistance for us?
Mr. Chair, so the section being referenced is 9.1 to 9.3, and it provides procedures for the commission to waive venue and jurisdictional defenses, and appears to be at their discretion.
Seeing no other testimony, we have got a very good idea. Representative Schumacher, I'm going to dispense with your final comments and move to the vote. I'm going to renew my motion that House File 4169 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. A roll call being requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Aye.
Representative Pugh.
Aye.
Representative Bliss.
Aye.
Representative Fenton.
Aye.
Representative Freiberg.
No.
Representative Halverson.
No.
Representative Jessup.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
No.
Representative Mason.
No.
Representative Nash.
Aye.
Representative Nelson.
No.
Representative Peterson.
Aye.
Representative Quam.
Aye.
Representative Sandsted. Representative Swazinski.
Aye.
Representative Tice.
Aye.
Representative West.
Aye.
Representative Joachim.
No.
The result of the roll call being 11 ayes and 6 nays, the bill is re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Representative Schumacher, we are done with that bill. It is my sincere hope and the hope of the committee that your second bill today will be much more in keeping in line with gravity than your previous bill. I will move House File 4226 before the committee to be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Representative Schumacher, if you will go ahead with your bill set up, we are ready for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this bill establishes a health policy commission. The intent really is to provide input and recommendations for how, as a state, we can better achieve improved care and health outcomes at lower cost through the commercial market and public programs. This bill establishes an independent health policy commission. The commission is independent and will work to understand why Minnesota ranks so high in health care costs and spending, identify what drivers are escalating health care costs and spending in Minnesota, and offer recommendations about policy, legislative, and market reforms that can be undertaken to bend the cost curve and improve care for quality Minnesotans. It will provide regular reports to the input, regular reports of input to the legislature, and will be supported by permanent professional staff with the expertise and skill set necessary to help the commission fulfill its mission. The commission will be populated with independent experts with demonstrated expertise in health finance, health economics, actuarial science, consumer advocacy, and health plan and health system management. It will also include representation from employers and purchasers of health insurance, physicians, those who provide services through MA, and those who depend on Minnesota's public health care programs. To ensure the commission's independence, a select group consisting of state economists and the state demographer, legislative auditor, and president of the Federal Reserve Bank in Minneapolis will recommend individuals for appointment to the commission and the Legislative Coordinating Commission to make appointments to the commission from that recommended group. Members, I ask for your support.
Representative Schumacher, any testifiers on behalf of your bill this morning?
No, I do have the Minnesota Chamber that is here to help with any questions that members may have.
Mr. Graves making his way to the testifying table. If you'll identify yourself and proceed with your testimony this morning, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Bentley Graves. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I know the time is brief, so I'll keep my comments short. Appreciate Chair Schumacher bringing this bill forward. There's data to suggest that Minnesota has some of the highest commercial health care costs in the country, and there's a lot of data to suggest that we spend at a very high rate for our public program enrollees. And so this commission, we think, can help us figure out what levers we might be able to pull to bend the cost curve, both in the commercial market and in public programs. And we appreciate the committee's support. Thank you.
Mr. Graves, thank you for your testimony. Having no other testifiers that have signed up in advance, we'll go to the public portion. Please make your way down, if you would. Anyone else wishing to testify on the matter before the committee, House File 4226, please proceed down to the testifying area. We'll get you queued up and ready to go. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, your name, Mr. Chairman.
And who you represent?
Kristen Longridge with the Minnesota Hospital Association, representing our 142-member hospitals through the state and our health care systems. Thanks for the opportunity to provide just some very brief comments on this legislation. You know, in the last 30 years, we've had numerous health care task forces, commissions, and working groups, and they've had varying degrees of success through the years. You know, one of the consistent issues with these working groups has been the direct legislative involvement in voting membership. MHA is concerned that in Subdivision 2 of the legislation, the legislators are not voting members, they're just ex officio, and we would recommend and suggest that the legislators be made full voting members of the commission. We're also concerned in Subdivision 13 with the length of time of the commission, that it does not sunset until 2034. While the Hospital Association does not support this legislation, we would be more comfortable if the sunset date could be shortened to potentially 2023. Thanks for consideration of our comments.
Thank you for being with us this morning and your testimony. Anyone else wishing to testify on the matter before the committee? House File 4226. Representative Schumacher, we will give you the final word, sir.
Please support my bill.
I move my motion that House File 4226 be referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion fails. Representative Schumacher, you are on your way. We will now revert to House File 2389, Representative Grunhagen. Representative Grunhagen. As Representative Grunhagen is making his way to the testifying table with his testifiers, I will move House File 2389 before the committee to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Representative Grunhagen, welcome to the committee. We hope that you'll follow the latter example of Representative Schumacher, not the former example of Representative Schumacher this morning with your testimony.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Chair and committee members, for hearing this bill. What this bill does is establish a working group to look at guidelines and ways to integrate alternative medical practices for pain management. With that, Mr. Chair, I have Valerie Overly here to testify on the bill.
Ms. Overly, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and if you're representing anyone, and then proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Valerie Overby. I'm the president of the Minnesota Acupuncture Association. We have been collaborating with Penny George, Alina, Mayo, and Northwestern Health Sciences regarding this initiative, as well as DHS. In brevity, we're just looking to establish integrative approaches, specifically regarding the opioid epidemic and how we could look at pain management. Some of our initial findings seem really streamlined. We're looking at making this a best practice that's not going to be cumbersome or cost effective. With that said, the working group is looking to have our findings prepared for the group by this August 1st of this year.
Members, questions for the testifier, Ms. Overby. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe testifier or the author, I did notice that a lot of the information you're collecting, you have folks that are on the working group that can provide that information or are experts in their field. I do notice that you mentioned as one of the modalities massage therapy, but then you don't have somebody from that organization on the working group. Is that something you considered maybe changing?
Representative Kernhagen.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yeah, that is being taken into consideration. We do have some additional stops here, also including a medical physician who currently works in an integrated situation. I think we're going to address in the next committee with an amendment.
Representative Joaquin, follow-up? Other questions for the testifier from the committee? We're looking good. We'll have you stand by in case something comes up. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on the matter before the committee? House File 2389. Anyone else today present that would like to testify on House File 2389? Seeing none and hearing none, Representative Grunhagen, we will give you the final word.
Appreciate support the bill.
Seeing no other member questions and other public testimony, I renew my motion that House File 2328 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion prevails. Representative Franson, if you will come forward, we'll take your bill next. And I will move before the Committee House File 3735 to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. As Representative Franson is making her way to the testifying table, again, House File 3735. And if there's anyone present who would like to testify on this, we'll ask you to go ahead and queue up, and Santa will get you signed in. And the committee anxiously awaits to hear your thoughts and testimony. Representative Franson, welcome to the committee.
Yeah, hi. Good morning. Good afternoon. Good morning.
Good day. Always works as I find out.
Good day. Happy Tuesday. So House File 3735 is a two-section bill that was brought to me by the Well Drillers Association. And the reason why we are here before you today is because of Section 2. So Section 2 would direct the agency to amend their rules regarding the reporting period for submitting records from 30 days to 90 days, just to help them with the making sure all the paperwork gets submitted in time and all that good stuff. The bill was heard in Health and Human Services Finance Reform, and then staff discovered that this provision was actually in statute. So there is an amendment that would amend the statute rather than the rule, and I believe that Representative Swidinski has that amendment.
Representative Branson, it is in our packet, and it does, it's the A1 amendment members.
Yeah.
And line 1.4, subdivision 9, talks about striking a 30-day completion to a 90-day completion. And that is an author's amendment?
Yes.
I will move the author's amendment, the A1, to House File 3735. To get the bill in the shape that the author wishes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed. Representative Franson, the bill is in the form that she would like.
Wonderful. Well, that's that. I don't know if anybody from the Well Drillers is here to testify.
Well, let's find out. If there's anyone present today who would like to testify on the matter before the committee, House File 3735 as amended. Anyone wishing to testify on House File 3735 as amended? Seeing none and hearing none. Member questions? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the one question I have is currently in some more rural areas of Minnesota, we're currently allowing plumbers to do some of this if they're trained and have capability of doing it. We're taking them out. So is this going to make well drillers have to drive farther to repair these? Racking up costs for the homeowners and businesses that have these wells, and I guess that's the question I have. I know it's kind of outside our purview, but it's just a question.
Representative Franson, did you want to respond to Representative Franson?
Yeah,
Nelson's
could
question?
You rephrase that? What was that actual question?
Mr. Chair, on line 2.19, we're taking licensed plumbers who repair these water pipes, currently can do this. We're taking, basically what the bill does is taking them out of it and making only well drillers be able to do this. And my understanding in some more rural areas that where there aren't well drillers readily available. This allows people to have it done by local people. They're going to be driving longer and therefore racking up more money because they're charged by mile how they have to get there. So is this going to raise costs for the individuals?
Representative Nelson,
they're well repaired.
What I think I'm going to do is I'm going to ask Mr. Gehring that question. Mr. Gehring. 2.19 to 2.22, I think the question and the genesis behind it is, by striking this language, does this prohibit plumbers from participating in these types of things and only leave it exclusively for well drillers? Have I summarized that?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I think the way that Representative O'Driscoll described it is correct, although I'm not super familiar with this bill, so we'll look into it after the committee and get back to you if that's different.
Well, Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, and then the second half, that's it. By doing that, you're going to rack up costs. As the welder will have to drive farther to do this, and not a local plumber, it's going to cost the homeowners or the businesses more, and they have to have their wells repaired.
Representative Nelson, if I might comment on that, I think it gives options. It doesn't say exclusively puts competition into the marketplace by allowing the installer, the well driller, to be able to go back and do it in addition to a plumber. That's just my read on that provision, but we have someone who is here to testify, but they can shed more light on it for us.
I think they came when I asked the question, so yeah.
Good morning and welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent and proceed with your testimony. And if you have any information on the question before us, we're eager to hear too.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For record, Bruce Clavin. I represent the Minnesota Water Well Association, folks that drill the wells, and they're licensed for this particular work. I understand the amendment was adopted earlier. I was up in Ag, so I understand that was adopted. The jurisdiction of the committee was Section 2.
We are plowing through bills today. Not
yep. So on your question, here's what happened. In about 2014, somebody up north had to have their well work done, and they couldn't find a well contractor close, so they had someone from maybe an hour and a half away. Guy drove up there. He got charged for the trip time, so they approached their member. And in 2014, the stricken language 2.19 to 2.22 came in, and it was based on geography, which really didn't make a lot of sense. It was 25 miles at the time, and we moved it to 50 in 2015. And our board has had some trouble with the concept of this, that if you're in a certain geographical area, you can call someone who's not as well trained to work on a well. And when you're working on a well, you're working at the top of the aquifer. So if you have a mistake, it's going straight down the aquifer. So our folks are trained in that particular area. And so this was more out of respect for the license that you get. Licensed plumbers can get this endorsement or this license, I understand. But the issue was working on the well itself. And so this was changed for one person a few years ago. And we talked about this at length in our board. And we can't think of any other area in the statute where the license is based on your geography. For example, Minlars has been a big deal. Can you imagine if you don't have a DMV office within 25 miles, you don't have to have a license, or you can get some other kind of license. So they wanted to go back to the way it was before 2015. But that's the backstory on Section 1, Representative Nelson.
Representative Nelson, does that help?
That answers.
Very good.
Yeah. Anyway.
Representative Mason.
Just a quick question. I've never had experience with a well-drill. Driller, how much education or training do they get? Where do they get it?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, I think it's 6 hours each year of continuing education, I think. I think there's someone from the department here, but that's my recollection of what they told me. So there's ongoing training about working on wells because of the water issue, being close to the aquifer.
Can I ask one other question? So if a plumber got that 6 hours, he would be qualified to do that?
Mr. Chairman, I represent Mason. I think you have to have the whole license. To keep up the license, you have to do the 6 hours. So I don't think it's just the 6 hours 1 year necessarily, but once you get it, you have to keep it up.
Okay.
The continuing education that many professional industries require.
Right.
Other member questions at this time? Anyone from the public wishing to testify on the matter before the committee? Again, the last opportunity here.
And Mr. Chairman, maybe on the amendment, since I was upstairs in Ag, if you adopted 1.14, just for the members' information, we have talked with the department reps, and they preferred 60 versus 90, and our folks were fine with that. So I don't know if you did an oral or could do an oral, but the department preferred 60, and we're fine with that. If we have to do it on the floor or down the road, that's fine too.
We have adopted the A1 amendment as drafted. That may be something that we'll have to deal with on the next committee stop since we've already adopted it this morning. because you could have done it as an incorporation to the A1 amendment, and at this point I'm just going to defer it to the HHS folks. Seeing no other member questions, seeing no other public testimony, I will renew my motion that House File 3735, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion prevails. Representative Bliss, we'll take you very quick. Representative Miller, I know you are here. We'll have you queue up. This will take us a very short period of time. You'll have the balance of the committee to take your bill with us. Representative Bliss. As Representative Bliss is making his way to the testifiers table on his bill, I will move House File 3018 to be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. Representative Bliss, your bill is in front of us. I see no amendments. We'll have you go ahead with your bill setup, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Today I'm presenting HF 3018. This bill create a task force to study charitable gambling taxation in Minnesota. I'm sure each of you had at least one organization in your district that does charitable gambling and donates those proceeds to the local community. There is an issue with the amount these organizations pay in taxes. This bill will set up a task force with legislators and stakeholders to drill down into the data and bring recommendations to us for the next budget cycle so we can make informed decisions on their tax policy. With me today is Al Lund, Executive Director for Allied Charities, to give a brief testimony and help any answers or
Good morning, any sir, and welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name and who you represent, proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Alan Lund. I'm the Executive Director of Allied Charities of Minnesota, and I'm here today to speak in favor of House File 3018. The current combined receipts tax that was enacted in 2012, the world and our industry has changed significantly since that time. To ensure the long-term viability of charitable gaming and to make sure the legislature has all of the necessary facts to have an informed discussion on our tax situation, we are asking for this task force to evaluate the current tax structure. This is a critical step to ensure a robust and thoughtful discussion of our industry and make sure these organizations can continue to give and contribute to their communities. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, questions of the testifier, the bill author at this time? Seeing none, we'll ask if there's any public testimony. Anyone here today wishing to testify on House 3018-3018, which is before the committee at this time? Anybody wishing to testify on House File 3018-3018? Seeing none and hearing none. Member questions? Seeing none, hearing none. Representative Bliss will give you the final word, sir.
Thank you. I appreciate your support.
I renew my motion, House File 3018, be referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion prevails. Representative Miller, if you'll make your way down, sir.
So, Mr. Chair, we have a half hour for this bill.
We do.
Can I ask some more questions about the first one?
Well, you may feel free to go ahead and do that in civil law. We'll be on that committee as well, Representative Fiber. Representative Miller, welcome to the committee, sir. I will move House File 4114 before the committee to be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. The bill is in front of us. Representative Miller, if you'll proceed with your bill setup, sir.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your patience with me juggling a lot this morning. So I promise I will be brief. Members, this is a bill that will be going through also on the jobs and energy. And what this is very quick review of what happened last year. The legislature and the governor signed into law the ability for Xcel to step away from their agreement to purchase energy through biomass in a place called Benson Energy in the city of Benson. And in that process, that moved to where they will eventually be closing down the plant. It is not closed yet. With the PUC's decision last week, we believe that'll be coming soon. And what has happened with this is, because this has happened so rapidly, this is placed, we took care of the issues in Benson last year. There was some money through the RDA that was given to the city of Benson and to address some severance and some things like that for people that were employed there. But there's a lot of suppliers and a lot of people in a company called North American Fertilizer that has been using the byproduct, where this sudden shift and change has made it difficult for them. They have a lot of equipment that can no longer be used. North American Fertilizer is facing a very difficult situation. And while I certainly do not believe that government is there to bail out, government is a business is a risk, and things sometimes happen that in this case the legislature made decisions last year that put these people in a pretty difficult position. So we tried, our first step was to try and extend the time that these would be open a little bit longer so that people could get their things in order. That was not able to do so. So we're moving forward with this bill that you see before you here, which will be to put some RDA money into a fund. And then the question before this committee today, Mr. Chair, is questions related to, we believe that the best route to do this is to go through an administrative law judge. That they can determine. In this bill, there's some parameters that we've given to the administrative law judge. There is a bill moving through the other body also that has slightly different language, but at this time, this is what we want to move forward with. So I'm open for. I do believe I have a couple people that very briefly want to speak to this. Oh, we have them lined up there. So right now, Mr. Chair, if I could have a couple testifiers.
Representative Miller, before we do that, I want to just compliment you. You did a very nice job of helping the committee to define our area of the bill. And I realize that this is also the first time that this bill is being heard, and so some background information by committee members might be needed. But members, we basically have the entire bill with the exception of Section 2, which is the compensation provision, the OEH information, and the setup as Representative Miller had spoken about. So with that, we'll bring your testifiers forward. I don't see any member questions right now. So I do have three individuals that have signed up in advance. We'll take those and see if there are others. Mr. Dane, welcome, sir. Good morning and welcome to the committee. Appreciate you being here today. If you'll state your name and who you represent and then proceed with your testimony, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee. My name is Scott Dane. I'm the executive director of the Associated Contract Loggers and Truckers in Minnesota. The majority of the suppliers being impacted by this action from last year are members of our trade association. First, I want to thank you for recognizing the need to address this issue, and we look forward to working with the committee and the legislature on resolving this and take into account the impacts for these people. I just have two quick issues I'd like to point out. One is that the legislation last year that created this situation referenced not only Benson Power, but also Laurentian Energy Authority, which are power plants up in Hibbing in Virginia. And our members are also suppliers of those facilities that will be losing their contracts as well. So I would like to have you consider at the appropriate committee level, including Laurentian Energy Authority suppliers in this legislation for compensation as well. The only other thing I'd like to mention real briefly is the figure that Representative Miller mentioned is $20 million in this.
30.
Oh, it's 40. Change of action.
No, it didn't change. It's 40.
Oh, okay. My mistake then. Good. That's good news to start with then. I'm done. No. We do appreciate everything, and you can get a chance to hear from people that correctly supply.
You're an easy customer to satisfy, it sounds like.
Just $20 million satisfies them, imagine that.
Again, thank you. We look forward to working with you.
Thank you, sir. We'll just have you stand by in case there are member questions that come up on the topic. Okay. The next testifier that we've had that has signed up in advance is Craig Mazinski, if I'm pronouncing that correctly or close to that, sir. I apologize. Good morning, sir, and welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name and proceed, and who you represent, proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Craig Matuszynski. I represent a group of 10 of the suppliers and haulers that are currently providing fuel and hauling services to deliver services to the Benson facility. I want to point out that this group has been instrumental in Benson being able to fulfill its mission up till this point, which is to provide the energy that was mandated, the biomass energy that was mandated under the original 1994 legislation and agreement between Northern States Power Company and the state of Minnesota that created the opportunity for Benson to be constructed and to go into operation. As part of that legislation for those, I don't know who, if anybody was here. I happened to be an employee of Northern States Power Company at the time, so I actually do remember this. One of the requirements in the original legislation had to do with a closed-loop biomass system or cultivated biomass being part of the requirement. Now, point out that this was done specifically because there was a recognition by the legislature in 1994 that keeping Prairie Island open, the benefits of keeping Prairie Island open, would flow mainly to Xcel's customers and mainly to people in the Twin Cities, Minneapolis-St. Paul area, while the burden associated with keeping the facility open would fall mostly on the Prairie Island community and rural Minnesota. And that was why we had the requirement for the closed-loop system. That's changed over time and evolved as things often do. Unfortunately, the legislation from last year really perfected the opportunity for Xcel to get the benefits for its ratepayers and basically caused my clients and the other people that were affected adversely by the legislation last year to have to subsidize Xcel's ratepayers. Now, my clients have invested over $100 million in equipment, stumpage rights, supply, those facilities, those sorts of things to support this investment. They will lose in excess of $60 million of economic value to their businesses as a result of the closure of the Benson facility. And this group represents, according to my estimation, only two-thirds or so of the total adverse economic impact to these rural Minnesota businesses. So the number, while Mr. Dane may be happy with a two tranches of $20 million or $40 million, that number will ensure that the administrative law judge or whoever is going to administer this process ends up having to ration the scarce resource for the damages that are accruing to the businesses that are affected. So that's kind of my first comment, that you're going to be in that particular realm as a result of this legislation. It will not be sufficient to compensate people fully. The second comment I would make specific to the legislation is that in the when it comes to the, I guess it is calculating the awards, subdivision 3, it would be, I think, beneficial to reduce that to a simple calculation of business value impact. And you've got all of the components of measuring business value impact, which should be determined by taking revenue, subtracting the actual cost of operations, cost of additional investment to keep the operations going, and coming up with a net present value calculation of that, and necessarily would include the impact from salvage value of equipment and mitigation effects and things like that. But it would be much simpler to have a single means for calculating the award than have everybody being able to be compared through the same method to everyone else, rather than one group putting in one method, one group putting in another, and I imagine some putting in both. The final comment I'll make has to do with the, I'll make two comments. One is, well, it has to do with time in both cases. One is mitigation, which is something that is absolutely necessary and important, something these guys have been thinking about to a great extent here as they try and mitigate their losses. Time would be beneficial on the mitigation front. Anything that can be done to extend the operations, even if it's only by a year, to help people plan, to help people potentially find alternate markets, would help mitigate, would help lower the burden on everybody involved. Finally, when we talk about deadlines, one of the things that's important to understand here is that these businesses have got significant debt on the equipment and facilities, equipment that they purchased, facilities that they've installed. And they continue to pay debt service to banks on those on their loans and leases and such. By this process, as it's laid out, payments would not be made until well after October 1st of 2019. And in that case, many of these businesses will have been foreclosed upon by the banks. They will be out of business. There will be no opportunity or very minimal opportunity to further mitigate the loss of jobs, the loss of business opportunity. My suggestion there would be to try and to tighten these deadlines to have a deadline of 30 to 45 days from the time that the plant closes for people to file their claims, and then try and make the payments within 45 to 60 days after that.
I could actually comment on it, Mr. Chair.
Representative Miller.
Mr. Chair, just to explain on Subdivision 5 deadlines, the rule, I'll call it the rules, that's probably the improper term, but the administrative law judge will put together the set of parameters by August 1st for applications of this year. And then it says a business seeking compensation under this section must file all claims with the administrative law judge by October 1st, 2018. Any offer settlement must be made by October 1st, 2019. I would anticipate that, I don't know how long the process will go with the administrative law judge. We certainly don't want to make things tough on him or her by rushing this, but I would certainly presume that this administrative law judge would come out with this is the compensation that we determined much before October 1st, 2019. But to be able to do this before August, I think, would just be very difficult for the administrative law judge to be able to
come. Well, Miller, I think you're probably right. There's going to be a discovery process that the Office of Administrative Hearings will have to go through. So, any questions for the testifier at this time? Seeing none, we'll have you stick by in case there is something. And our next testifier, who has signed up in advance, Mr. Sean Fletcher, if he wants to come forward, and as he's ready himself with his testimony, I'll also ask if there's anyone else present who would like to testify on the matter before the committee today. House File 4114. Again, House File 4114. Mr. Fletcher, welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record and who you represent, proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, my name is Sean Fletcher with Fletcher Trucking, and I'm from Brainerd, Minnesota. I'm a trucker and a logger. I supply the biomass to both facilities, Benson and Laurentian Energy. I've invested $12.5 million in equipment since 2014. And all this biomass equipment to supply Benson Power and Laurentian Energy. I have loans from 5 to 15 years on my equipment and my buildings to maintain all this equipment. I relied on this biomass mandate, and I relied on it to supply fuel till 2028. When I met with the owners of Benson Power back in 2016 and agreed on some pricing concessions, I was assured that this would run through the PPA, or the Power Purchase Agreement. I will not be able to start hauling my product somewhere else when this is over. There's no other place to go. Dealers already right now won't even take biomass equipment on trade hardly. I mean, it's worth nothing in this state. I have numerous timber permits that I purchased in advance. We buy them probably 2-3 years in advance sometimes. And we're going to have all them losses besides. I will lose millions along with many others while all the ratepayers save money. We should all be made whole. And the number is not even 40 million. I think Craig talked about around 100 million. I think Excel's rate payers should pay also. Last fall back in the PUC, Excel's attorney told the PUC members that if they didn't get their 9% return on their money that they were going to invest in the deal, they weren't even going to do the deal at all. So I think that the rate payers for them weren't number one. I don't think I'm asking for anything more than to be made whole. I don't want any blue sky, no extra money. And I would like the payment to be simplified 30 days after plant closure, my payments are still due. I mean, it's going to be tough to deal with banks months later when we're already behind on our payments and tell them that we think we're going to get some money here. I mean, we have to pay our bills. And it's going to be hard to borrow money. I mean, you go to the bank, it's going to be difficult. So I'd like to see something. I noticed everybody else is getting payment when the plant shuts down. I just thought there should be a simpler process to so we could get something when the plant shuts down also. We didn't get heard last year, but I do really appreciate you guys taking the time and listening to us this year. And that's all.
Mr. Fletcher, thank you for being with us here today. You certainly have a lot that you're going through these days. Members, questions for Mr. Fletcher at this time? Mr. Fletcher, wanted to have you hang tight. Representative Quam, I know you had a question.
I can wait until after the...
Okay, after testifiers? Okay, well, we'll keep you on the list then. Mr. Fletcher, we'll have you hang tight in case there's a question that comes up for you in the process. We'll go with testifiers who have come forward, and then we'll catch you. Right? But again, if there's anyone else who has not testified on the matter before the committee today, House File 4114-4114 will invite you to get queued up with Santa, and she'll get you into the rotation. Good morning and welcome. If you state your name and who you represent, proceed with your testimony.
Hi, Wesley. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Shelley Buck. I'm president of the Prairie Island Indian Community Tribal Council. I am here today to testify on behalf of my tribe in opposition of House File 4114, the Biomass Business Compensation Bill. Our tribe's reservation is situated only 600 yards from Xcel Energy's nuclear power plant. We are the closest community to a nuclear power plant anywhere in the world. Or anywhere in the country, I'm sorry. Every day we live with the consequences of this country's failed nuclear waste policy. In 1994, we forcefully and vocally opposed legislation to give Xcel the right to store nuclear waste in dry casks adjacent to our community. Despite our strenuous opposition, this legislative authority for storage of the nuclear waste was enacted. Currently, there are 40 dry cask storage units filled with spent nuclear fuel on the pad at Prairie Island Nuclear Plant, with an additional 3 casks to be added this year to the aging facility. And by the time the plant is decommissioned in 2034, they're licensed for up to 96. The legislature in 1994 did not completely ignore the obvious concerns. For example, the 1994 legislation created a renewable development fund and provided that, I quote, funds in the account can only be expended for development of renewable energy resources, end quote. This tied the intent of the fund to eliminating the dependence on nuclear waste, on nuclear energy, and solving the nuclear problem for communities such as ours. Despite this clear direction of the 1994 law, for years legislators had appropriated funds from the RDF for purposes of doubtful value for the development of renewable energy resources. We have consistently opposed these transfers. Of the $327 million that has been designated to the RDF, not one penny has been allocated to the Prairie Island Indian community to pursue our renewable projects. The legislation before you would take $40 million, most of the balance of the renewable development account, and use it for payments to private parties that will result in absolutely no development of renewable energy and will not solve the nuclear waste problem. We believe this is a clear violation of the letter and the spirit of the 1994 law, and we vigorously oppose it. The question becomes, if we give away all the fund again as proposed in this bill, where does it end? If the legislature decides that the truckers and loggers should be reimbursed, the funding should come out of the state general fund, not the renewable development account. We urge you to honor the commitment in the original Prairie Island law and not pass House File 4114.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony today. Members, President Buck also has some written testimony that was provided to the committee for your consideration today as well. Thank you. Member questions today for President Buck? Seeing none, we'll just have you stand by in case some questions do come up. We'll proceed and provide us your name and who you represent and proceed with your testimony. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Tammy Pusta. I'm the Chief Judge at the Office of Administrative Hearings, and I'd like to start with two things. First, an apology. We have been busy standing up a new technology system for the workers' comp system throughout the state of Minnesota. It went live yesterday, and as a result, I have not met with you, and I apologize for that.
Second.
We have a reunion right here.
Excited about the testimony at this point.
Yeah. Second, I am not here to take a position, obviously. I'm a judge. I don't take policy positions. So with regard to your last testifier and the testifiers before me, those aren't my issues. I have concerns about the process that's laid out in this bill and, frankly, also in the companion bill in the Senate. I would like to just raise the issues and make a pledge to continue to work with authors if this bill continues to go forward. Would that be sufficient?
Absolutely.
And very quickly. So first, the bill itself says that if, in fact, the legislature wants to run a claims process, that the Office of Administrative Hearings will do that. Again, I'd say we work for the government. We'll do whatever you tell us to do. So if that's what the legislature wants us to do, that's what we'll do. But we'll need more direction. First of all, the legislation at one point calls it to consider and award claims. That's one thing. At another point in the legislation, it talks about making offers of settlement. Judges don't make offers of settlement. If you want us to actually decide who gets money and who doesn't get money, that's one thing, but we don't negotiate. We don't make offers of settlement, so we'd like that removed. Second, one of the things that it asks us to rely on and make choices between the competing claimants is whether they have a valid contract. And then in other parts it says, but you don't have a valid contract, but you have an ongoing business relationship. As a judge, I'm going to need to know, how do you want to knock those up against each other? Does one have priority over another, or do they not? Are they equal? Next, there are two different kinds of claims that this legislation allows people to bring. One is a claim for decreased net revenue, and another is a claim for loss of the value of their investment in real or personal property. This language really needs to be looked at from an accounting point of view so that we can have standardization in terms of the financial statements that are submitted for a judge to determine. Why would that be necessary? I've heard as I sat here that there's not going to be enough money, if in fact this happens, to fund all claims. Therefore, a judge is going to need to make choices between claims. Therefore, to enact what the legislature intends us to enact, we need you to tell us how you want those priorities to be so a judge can do what it is you want them to do. Next, there is there's references in here to claimants having tried to find other sources of revenue, which certainly, you know, as a policy matter, I understand. But the way it's drafted, it's a disincentive because if in fact you've done that, that comes off your claim. So if it comes off your claim, I would assume that people are going to stop trying to find ways to mitigate losses because it's going to come off your claim. So that's an issue. The prioritization language, we'd need more stronger. I've mentioned that as well. There's also language about a cap, and that is on page 2 at lines 3.1 to 3.4. It says that no matter who you are and what your claim is, nobody gets awarded more than the eligible business's annual net revenue generated from the contract or the not contract for the past 5 years, multiplied by 2. I read that to mean 10 years. I think it can also be read to mean, no, it's a 5-year average, that's one number, times 2. I can't tell, a judge won't be able to tell. We'll need that clarified. The next issue is having to do with appeals. I appreciate that, of course, anything that you ask people to go to a court for, they should have a right to have another court look at it. In this particular case, though, on lines 3.26 and line 3.27, the appeal language, the reference to Chapter 14 isn't going to get them anywhere except to OAH, which is fine. We can Chinese wall them from one administrative law judge to another, but you need to say in here that the claims that we awarded are final, because if it's not a final decision, there's no way to get to an appeal. If it's just an award of claims that comes back to the legislature and you bless it next session or you don't, that's a different process and it's not identified. Mm-hmm. And my, I believe, very last concern is the funding language on lines 4.10 to 4.15. I may have explained this to you before, but the Office of Administrative Hearings on this side of our business gets no general fund money, and that's fine. We eat what we kill, which means just like any law firm, we bill for our time.
this language about, I mean, it's intended to allow us to bill against the pot of money, whatever it is the pot of money is going to be, but the language needs to reference back into 1458, which is how MMB knows to allow us to do our process. And again, those are all very specific things I wanted to make a record of, and I again apologize for not raising them privately and promise to help fix this if we go that far.
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Thank you for your time. Representative Miller.
Absolutely. And, Mr. Chair, the challenge with this, we're kind of already expressing how complicated and how difficult this is going to be. And so what my hope was and intention of this was to basically lay, with the help of some people that put this together, to give parameters but not too tight of parameters, with the intent that this discussion was going to happen later, but I'm hearing the discussion needs to happen before. So I'm totally supportive of that, and what I would argue is this is probably almost the meat. So the bills between us and the Senate are basically administrative law judge $40 million. And then how we figure out the mechanism in between there is really where the difficult work is, and so I look forward to working with them and coming up with a plan that works. The last thing I want to do is throw something on their lap where they say, thanks a lot, now what are we going to do, sort of thing, because that's just going to hurt everyone even more. So we'll certainly work on that.
Representative Miller, you're on the track of what I was looking at, since the two of you have not had a chance to all, say, meet and discuss this issue. But for the committee time right now, that some of these things you probably could have had a chance to work through and maybe come with some clarification on here. My question to you is, if this does leave the committee today, will you continue to work with the Office of Administrative Hearing to take into consideration their suggestions so that, as it makes sense, you get at least two or three other committee stops along the way to refine that? Because many of those items dealt with the dispensation of compensation, for lack of a better term on that, which is kind of a finance committee related topic, but within the purview of this committee, it is a policy committee, so the more global overriding policy, yes or no, is what I believe is within the jurisdiction of this community. So I have a commitment from the two of you to continue to do that work, to provide clarification as we get into the disposition of compensation.
Mr. Chair and committee, absolutely yes, and this not only has some committee stops, but there's going to be plenty of time for, even if there's people in this room that want to add input or things like that. If this should be successful, even in the House, as you can tell, this is going to go into a conference committee where I think there's going to be further work done, because we don't have total agreement with the Senate on this time as how to approach this. So there will absolutely be a commitment to work with them, and I appreciate so much for coming to this. And
thank you. Is there anyone else present who has not had a chance to testify that would like to testify on the matter before the committee? Representative Kwan and Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author. As the chair hinted on, there's testimony today brought up a few things that maybe need some work as it moves through committees. President Buck stated what the original intent of the source funding was, but you know, this committee, the legislature, oftentimes changes things, such as the original situation that we're seeing is because the state jumped on the bandwagon of a technology, a process that ended up not being very feasible or practical, and that in 13 and 14 the legislature voided out the contract that Excel had and forced on this this mess worse by frankly at the LEC we found out the majority of the cost of the fuel is transportation, much of it from Wisconsin, and it's a very convoluted, messy process. And when the legislature, I'm not sure if I'd call it willy-nilly, but voids out contracts, ignores realities, people get hurt. And this attempt to try and provide justice to winners and losers caused by the ramifications of what we do is commendable, but I'd like to assist the author in trying to look at the fairest way of doing it so it doesn't appear before the Claims Committee later on in the years to come. Thank you.
Representative Nelson, followed by Representative Joaquin, followed by Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess I'm kind of thinking on the same lines as Representative Kwam here. Concerned this is going to set a precedent. We take action, cause harm to some business or change in some business model,
and then they're going to come back to us to ask for us to compensate them. And I have concerns about that, and I appreciate the fact that we created this mess. We created the mess at the beginning. The Benson Project, the building trades, which I was a part of, pushed this project also in the beginning to get it built because it was building jobs. So I've known about this project for a long time, and long before I was in the legislature. I have some concerns that we're opening the state checkbook up and how we're going to pay for this. And I don't think the renewable fund is the proper place to take the money out of, but a concern that this would set a precedent for any future action the legislature has, people coming back at us to have to pay for their losses. So I'm concerned. And I understand what Representative Miller is trying to do here, and I have sympathy for that, but like I said, I'm just concerned. Again, we're setting precedents in the future.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll try to be quick. I echo a lot of what everybody said. I'm really disturbed that we're raiding the RDF fund once again and breaking promises. And hearing also from the ALJ and how complicated this would be for the OIH to actually do this, it seems like it really needs some more work. And that while the underlying sentiment, I can completely understand the loss of business and what's happening to these communities around the businesses that are closing, I just don't think this is the best approach. And since so much of what the concerns for the OAH process is in our jurisdiction, I would kind of hope that we hold off and wait on this bill instead of moving it forward.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I agree that this feels like there's enough questions here that maybe moving it forward is not the smartest idea. I know that we want to be sure that we meet deadlines and all that stuff. I get real concerned when I hear we're just going to take care of it in conference committee, because conference committees aren't as public as the committees that we convene as members. And we don't know who's going to be on the conference committee, and it's a small group, and we don't know when they're going to meet. This is where our work needs to get done. And looking at the underlying statute, 116C, 0.779, subdivision 1, paragraph F, there is a very clear standard that has to be laid out. There's a big process that has to be followed in here in terms of making decisions about changing the expectations of where this money is going to be spent. So we did put, clearly there's some flexibility in the law, so the advisory group can come together and petition the commission to change how the money is spent. But it's not clear to me if this process has been followed per statute. There's some permissive language in here, but it looks like it's tied to process. And so, Representative Miller, can you comment on the process laid out in paragraph F and how that was followed?
Representative Miller, do you have
you're going to have to copy it back. Yeah,
excuse me.
Copy right here.
Very good.
Just want to make sure it back what you're talking about.
3.1. I'm looking in the actual statute. So if you look to the bill in line 1.11, it references the statute that established this fund. And so I went to look at the actual statute to see, because it's not just a pot of money that the state gets to raid whenever they want. There are procedures that are set out to do this. And so that piece of statute that's referenced has a very clear steps that apparently need to be followed in order for the commission to make changes to how these funds are distributed. And I'm not sure how that process has worked out behind the scenes with the commission.
Representative Miller, we are a little bit over time, but I would like to see if we can adjudicate this matter today.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I hope we can answer this. When I read this is making reference to kind of basically the Benson Biomass Plant is what this is referencing in this statute. Now, as far as the process that you're talking about,
the balance that we're trying to strike between the administrative law judge is I was told they need some parameters. I'm hearing quite a bit tighter parameters than I had anticipated, more because I wanted to give them the latitude to do what they need to do. So there's kind of that strike and balance, because if we tell them this is exactly how you adjudicate it, well, then we're not going before a judge. We're just saying this is how you're going to administrate this process. So we're going to work with them. I'm thankful for them to come here today and say that they're going to work through this process. If you're asking about the process of the money that's going to be allotted to this, that's going to be in the other committee. We're going to have to talk about that there.
Representative Helberson, final question.
Well, that doesn't answer my question, because there actually is statute that says how the commission is supposed to make changes to how the money is spent. So if we don't follow all of the things that were laid out with regard to how the money is supposed to be spent, there is flexibility that the legislature provided, but the process, there is a process in order to do a workaround that's not, doesn't appear to be provided for in what we're seeing in front of us. So unless I'm seeing it differently, this is a lot of complex stuff to try to put together in a short amount of time, but I have a lot of concerns that we're not even following statute with this.
Members, what I want to do is I would like to we're going to take a vote on this, and Representative Nelson, Representative Joachim, Representative Halverson, I want to just make a couple of quick comments. Representative Nelson, I think that this process goes forward, we will learn about what we made in our mistakes, and if we stop right now, we don't learn from our mistakes as we go through the committee process, so I think it warrants moving it forward. Representative Joachim, I did hear the judge and Representative Miller said that they wanted to work on it. This is the first time in front of the committee that they've had a chance to visit. And Representative Halverson, I heard Representative Miller say that the Senate may be taking a different approach to this, and that's where the conference committee part would take process. I did not hear him say that he was going to try to circumvent our committee processes and taking public input and working with stakeholders along the way on that. So members, with that, I renew House File 4114, be referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. We are adjourned. Yeah.